Sunstone presents this live recording from the 1987 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 26th through the 29th. We take you to the Marriott Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
To be delivered this morning, entitled Trouble in Paradise, The Positive Value of Love, Sex, and Danger in the Movies. Delivering the paper will be Paul Swenson, who will be representing Utah Holiday as the film critic, although he also sits as editor of that magazine. Comments will follow by Paul Larson, who is a local screenwriter. Paul and I sort of have an inside joke that Paul's a screenwriter, but he really doesn't write for the screen. He writes for himself. I know Paul, both of these men, fairly well, and I'm excited to hear their comments today. Following the papers, if there are any comments, we will field some questions and we'll proceed as outlined.
After Phyllis Tribble's incredibly powerful paper yesterday, entitled Women's Work Has Never Done, Feminist Interpretation of the Bible, in which we get to revisit the Garden of Eden with a new perspective on the creation story and what went on there, and her reinvigoration of the erotic tenderness of the Song of Songs, I'm tempted to retitle my paper, Tribble in Paradise. I really identified with what she said. Melanie Minch Charles, who also spoke yesterday in a paper called The Reconstruction of Heaven, has given me a whole new way to look at love, sex, and danger in life, if not in the movies. But today it's Trouble in Paradise, Positive Value of Love, Sex, and Danger in the Movies. While AIDS has supposedly ended the sexual revolution, sex and love are still on the front lines on the silver screen. Here, the battle of the sexes is being fought on both old and new turf over issues freshly raised or enlivened by the women's movement. Woody Allen's favorite films of 1986, he told an interviewer at Oscar time last spring, were Blue Velvet and A Room with a View. While there may have been a few gasps of astonishment, some from feminist or liberal enclaves where Woody is beloved, not many bothered to respond or to wonder why these pictures left their mark on Allen. A few may have observed that the seeming polarity of Allen's choices, taken together, had a strange completeness. Blue Velvet is a descent into hell, a peeling back of the thin veneer of normality and respectability in a vaguely 1950-ish American small town. Underneath is sexual obsession, sadism, masochism, and murder. A Room with a View, meanwhile, set in England and Italy in the first years of this century, is a pricking of pretentiousness, a subtle rolling back of sexual repression. Yet both films represent deeply romantic views of life. As movies become more routinely violent and writers and filmmakers find new ways to up the ante of casual brutality in a 90-minute picture, sex and violence are often loosely equated as behavioral byproducts of a chaotic, volatile, modern environment, an environment in which men and women must respond instinctively and unfeelingly to each other, in which the four-letter Anglo-Saxon words for lovemaking are all thinly veiled hostilities. As Oliver North has recently informed us, we live in a dangerous world. Under the threat of impending doom, it becomes only mildly reprehensible for the United States to sell arms to terrorist nations or for Hollywood to sell comic book violence as entertainment. With RoboCop, for example, Dutch director Paul Verhoeven's first film made in the United States, he's playing both sides of the satirical street. Verhoeven parodies the incidents of violence in American life and American movies, but he also artfully uses his picture to step up the volume of that violence, to raise the acceptable cinematic level of commonplace death and destruction. We may conclude that amid the horrendous din and danger of modern life, sexual pleasure and violent confrontation must be savored where you find them. At any rate, that's what John Badham's recently released Stakeout, one of the noisiest movies I've ever seen, seems to be saying. Its protagonists, sympathetic police detectives Richard Dreyfuss and Emilio Estevez, must react quickly to stay alive. In between labored breaths, any of which may be their last, they grab for life. Dreyfuss risks his career and the delicate chemistry of a police stakeout in a blackly comic love affair with a woman they are keeping under surveillance, the ex-girlfriend of an escaped psychotic killer. Sex, death, and danger are interrelated in this kind of film and occasionally seem almost interchangeable. In selecting a title for this paper, I'm not using danger, by the way, as a euphemism for violence. In so-called action-adventure films like Predator and Rambo, violent death is the raison d'etre for the genre. In modern movies as diverse as Top Gun and Beverly Hills Cop 2, violence is added like sugar to junk cereals to produce a rush at key intervals in the screenplay, or like caffeine to soft drinks. Now, there's a metaphor we can relate to. To stimulate a sort of addiction. What I am suggesting is that as an element of life and the movies, danger can be used synergistically to enhance or enliven other elements. While many of us may live lives of quiet domestic desperation, removed from threat or harm, we should not be willing to throw out the baby with, as a Utah woman was recently overheard exhorting, the dishwater. There is a germ of paradoxical but plausible significance that filmmakers like Paul Verhoeven and John Badham are, however clumsily, exploring. Love, commitment, and passion are sometimes born in the crucible of opposition. Risk can be a catharsis that opens us up to ourselves and to others. Pressured by contemporary life, we may burst the artificial barriers often imposed between spirituality and sensuality. An idiosyncratic filmmaker such as Ivan Passer, for instance, can advance the idea of sensuality as a healer in the little-known but fine romantic comedy Creator with Peter O'Toole and Mariel Hemingway. Jonathan Demme can make us laugh and think at the same time with Something Wild, a comedic thriller about the thrill of breaking the rules and the hell there is to pay for it. John Irvin's Turtle Diary with Ben Kingsley and Glenda Jackson is a picture in which, quote, nothing happens. Two middle-aged lonely people meet, agree to steal three giant turtles from the zoo, do so and release them into the sea, then part, and everything happens. They love, they feel, and they confront the people and issues in their lives with a new energy. Can we be moved by sexual expression that is at times, or that is transitory and risky, but is portrayed as enjoyable? In Chris Bernard's gritty working-class British comedy, A Letter to Brezhnev, blonde, big-shouldered Teresa and dark, effervescent Elaine are like Pop-Tarts fresh from the cosmic toaster, their lips and cheeks as ripe as boysenberry marmalade. But when they conspire to play, quote, hard to get for the Russian sailors they meet in a flashy Liverpool disco, they poignantly remind each other, we're not whores. One of them will risk everything for love in a totally alien culture. The other will continue to work in a chicken processing plant by day and continue to throw herself into a series of one-night stands with rotating lovers with humor and enthusiasm and remain completely loyal to her friend's need for something more. The positive value of love, sex, and danger in the movies is that we may be forced to confront stereotypical notions of what may constitute trouble in our own particular paradise. The centerpiece scene in A Room with a View, James Ivory's and Ismail Merchant's wonderful British adaptation of the Forsyth novel, unfolds in a backwater Eden in the English countryside, and features a startling and charming tableau of full frontal male nudity. One is conscious while watching two men and a boy romp and play in a pond, splashing and wrestling, chasing one another along the bank in a mock macho ballet, of the myths and the fears we have invested in the nude human body. It is a scene of almost pre-Adamic innocence, and it is also stupendously funny. The players are the lovesick freethinker George Emerson, Freddie Honeychurch, the knockabout younger brother of Lucy, a woman for whom George harbors a steadfast but unrequited love, and Mr. Beebe, perhaps the earthiest vicar we have ever seen on screen. As the three males scamper and frolic in uninhibited, unselfconscious seclusion, the camera shows us a trio of fully clothed intruders descending the path into the deeply forested glade. Dressed in white is George's inamorata, Lucy Honeychurch, played by British actress Helena Bonham Carter, of the bee-stung lips and independent spirit, whose engagement to Cecil Vyse, the upper-class twit, who accompanies her down the path into the glade, reflects the unresolved residue of her Victorian upbringing. Cecil and Lucy are chatting amiably with Lucy's mother, a woman of uncommon down-to-earthiness, who is both happy that her daughter soon will be marrying well and increasingly irritated at Cecil's stuffiness. Suddenly, from out of the underbrush, Mr. Beebe and George and Freddie emerge, naked, startled, and slightly abashed. Beebe dives across the path for cover. Freddie retreats behind a bush, and George, for a moment, is spread-eagled in front of the trio, caught between safety and full disclosure. Lucy and George have not seen each other since their encounter in Italy, where something in the Italian air and temperament had awakened Lucy to life's tempestuous possibilities. The first epiphany had come in an Italian town square where the sudden beating of a villager and an eruption of random savagery burst upon Lucy's consciousness like a shot. Italians are so kind, so lovable, Lucy had said, and yet at the same time, so violent. After the excitement, George had found that he and Lucy could talk to each other with the peculiar vibration of people who had made contact. A veil had been pierced, and although Lucy was unwilling to admit it to herself, she would never be the same again. On a sun-drenched hillside overlooking Florence, George had climbed a tree and proclaimed his creed, "Truth, B. beauty! Sought out Lucy and kissed her passionately. And as an electrical storm gathered overhead, shocked and disturbed by this open challenge to her confused sensibilities, Lucy has returned to England and hidden her emotions in her safe, unstimulating engagement to Cecil. Now, in the familiar greenery of her own English woods, Lucy is confronted with a comic image of the strange and intense young man whose earlier disruption of her inquisitive yet orderly psyche she has tried so desperately to repress. While Lucy's brother Freddie hides his genitals with a fern, Mrs. Honeychurch lectures him that he could have enjoyed a much more comfortable bathe at home. Cecil brandishes his umbrella, slicing the air and parting the dense foliage of the lush green woods, mounting a protection for the women against the improprieties and the images of lust that hide there. As George scrambles for cover, Lucy laughs. It is a golden and glorious sound, and it signals a shift in her relationship with George, a shift she will soon have to face. A much more shocking confrontation occurs two-thirds of the way through Blue Velvet, that nonetheless reveals, as does the scene in A Room with a View, the depth of the relationship of a young couple. Nudity also plays a part in this scene, and its power devolves from its almost surreal contrast with the starkly ordinary clothing styles and furnishings of a middle-class American family in a mid-20th century American home. The thematic cross-currents of shame, love, and guilt in David Lynch's controversial film coalesce in this scene, and we are forced to contrapose what may be our own conflicting emotions about sex, loyalty, deceit, and the limits of romantic love. Blue Velvet has been attacked for its explicit sexuality, its alleged voyeuristic interest in sexual violence, and its emotional mix of terror, humor, tenderness, and pain. By setting the film in a small American town called Lumberton, where the disc jockeys introduce each new tune at the sound of the falling tree, Lynch captures some of the strangeness of growing up in the 50s. Among the songs on the radio are Bobby Vinton's Blue Velvet and Roy Orbison's In Dreams, full of intensely sentimental, almost infantile images that become haunting and ominous in the surreal contrasts of Lynch's world. Smiling firemen wave from a red engine as it passes through a neatly trimmed neighborhood. A young university student home in Lumberton to visit his hospitalized father, who has suffered a stroke, pokes amid the rubble in a vacant lot and discovers a dismembered human ear. It is not Lynch's purpose to expose the venality of small-town America. He shows us the humor and the fondness of the relationship of the protagonist, Jeffrey Beaumont, with the employees of his father's hardware store, where he fills in while his dad is hospitalized. He shows us the closeness, but he shows us the loneliness, too. And he shows us the underside of the insularity. I was recently struck by a story that I've read called Raquel, a vivid reminiscence by writer Sharon Dubiago of her California childhood. In this story, she recalls how her family was uprooted from a populous Los Angeles suburb. She and her brother and sister were enrolled in a small rural high school, quote, because my parents believed that people in the country were innocent. In the small northern Utah community in which I grew up, a place that still today is said to be a wonderful place to raise a family, the teenage, clean-cut son of my earnest Mormon bishop casually revealed to a group of us one night how he had participated in the shameful sexual humiliation of a girl from the other side of town. And in a peaceful town in Utah County today, as we have recently read in the newspapers, parents and young people are just now beginning to deal with the enormity of a darker and more extensive community secret. In the film Blue Velvet, Jeffrey Beaumont and Sandy Williams are the young people who fall in love against the lurid backdrop of Jeffrey's obsession with a woman named Dorothy Valens. The extent to which we become involved and are drawn into the lives of Jeffrey, Sandy, and Dorothy has a great deal to do with how closely we identify with these personality types. Jeffrey, played by Kyle MacLachlan, is an obsessive compulsive with a need to make sense of the dark secrets he discovers in the lives around him. Sandy, played by Laura Dern, is bright, sensitive, trusting. She's also possessed of an almost mystical innocence. Dorothy, the dark, haunted cabaret singer, played by Isabella Rossellini, appears to cooperate in her own destruction. Brought low by her relationship with a drug dealer named Frank Booth, she teases herself with the illusion that she can use her own body to negotiate for the release of her kidnapped husband and child. Jeffrey's obsessive-compulsive behavior places him in a triple bind. Discovering the ear, the apparent emblem of some gruesome crime, he does the proper thing. He places it gingerly in a paper sack and delivers it to the police detective who lives in his neighborhood. But then he does the highly improper thing. He enlists Sandy, the detective's daughter, to help him insinuate himself into the devious doings at the Deep River Apartments, a seedy locale that Sandy has overheard mentioned in her father's conversations. "No one will suspect us," Jeffrey tells Sandy. "Nobody would think that two people like us would be crazy enough to do something like this." From the living room closet in Dorothy's apartment, Jeffrey observes Booth's physical and psychological abuse of Dorothy. Even while attempting to help Dorothy, he finds himself nominally participating in her victimization. He is both paralyzed by her plight and attracted to her sexually. He is submerged in the evil he has set out to discover and eradicate. He becomes involved with Dorothy sexually, yet his courage and his compassion nominate him as Dorothy's potential savior. Jeffrey has loyalties to Sandy, to Dorothy, and to Sandy's father, and he can't walk away from any of them. "People are given an opportunity to gather knowledge and experience in this life," Jeffrey tells Sandy. "Sometimes we have to take the risk." "I don't know," Sandy replies, "whether you're a detective or a pervert." As David Chute has pointed out in his interview with David Lynch and brilliant commentary on Blue Velvet in the October 1986 issue of Film Comment magazine, Blue Velvet, quote, "mirrors the journey into hell format of such recent American political epics as Missing, Under Fire, and especially Salvador. As significant as the descent in all of these films is the long ascent out the other end. The pulling back in Blue Velvet is as painful as the plunging in. The quality of an extended dream that informs the mercurial motivations and actions of the major characters reaches us at a deeply subconscious level. The picture's sordid eroticism is at times smudged by ambiguity, and at others insightfully illuminated, just as it might be in the most powerful of our dreams or in the occasional unreality of our own real lives. While David Lynch pushes this material on the level of surrealist thriller beyond what Hitchcock might have attempted, he pushes it even further as a personal, human, and romantic tour de force that takes his characters through a torturous process of love, shame, and redemption. Sandy and Jeffrey find love in what Jeffrey calls a strange world. There is no doubt that the cosmos that Lynch creates is peculiar, but there is something familiar about it as well. In an astonishingly intimate scene early in the film, just as Jeffrey begins his descent into nightmare, Sandy and Jeffrey converse in a darkened automobile against the glow of a church's stained glass window. As Sandy relates her dream of the night before, what she describes as, quote, an exaltation of robins, the look on her face approaches bliss. This is not the bliss of the martyred saints frozen in the glass behind her, nor is it the slightly creepy ecstasy that slackens the faces of the studio audiences of televangelist Jimmy Swaggart, if you've seen that program. It is a vision of passion and joy, and while rationally we may distrust its telling, we cannot help but be moved by the warmth and the beauty in Sandy's face. Later, in the darkened basement alcove of a friend's home, late in the picture, Sandy and Jeffrey share a slow dance together that lets us know the depth of their relationship, less by what is said than by what is felt. The scene is Lynch's only concession to American dating rituals. Sandy is in a bare-shouldered dress, Jeffrey in a sports coat. And because of the austerity of its emotion, the unpretentiousness of the surroundings, and the brevity of the moment, it's a date we will not soon forget. Later that night, in Sandy's equally understated living room, a beaten, bruised, and naked Dorothy will cling to Jeffrey for comfort under the astonished gaze of Sandy and her mother, whose faces mingle shock, compassion, and disillusion. Respectability and risk have never collided under less ordinary nor more auspicious circumstances. It is a funny, terrifying, and heartbreaking scene, a prelude to a long, dark night of conflict for Jeffrey. Because David Lynch makes us look through Jeffrey's eyes at both beauty and depravity in Blue Velvet, we sense more clearly why moviegoing is a voyeuristic experience. Like Jeffrey, we are curious about the intimate workings of other people's lives. Our communal experience together in a darkened theater is tacit permission to watch, to feel, and to become involved. For those able to distance what they see on the screen and yet make connections with their own lives, movies, like dreams, are images of our shared fantasy lives. What those images tell us when we look in the movie mirror may make cheaper sense than psychotherapy and may occasionally be more fun. The British, whose film industry is now exporting a whole new wave of sexually candid films, in which women often are determined to control their own sexual and romantic destinies, in everything, for instance, from Half Moon Street to Letter to Brezhnev, which I referred to earlier, to Mona Lisa, to Personal Services, and the soon-to-arrive Wish You Were Here, and Rita Sue and Bob, too. The British are cynical about Americans' preference for violent escapist fare. Writing in the August 11, 1987 Village Voice, Graham Fuller says, "We Brits know that sex is fun and daft, and we balk at the uncompromising humorlessness of the way it's handled by the U.S. media. Sex in America is problematic, like menstruation in certain Stone Age tribes. It has to be, quote, dealt with. Violence, says Fuller, is the sex of American movies. It's what they take for granted and think is fun." Ironically, American films have been invested in the character of James Bond, perhaps the most famous Brit in the world, the sort of slick commercial violence and passionless sex that is the hallmark of a certain kind of American movie. In her poem, The James Bond Movie, Mae Swenson tells us, "The popcorn is greasy, and I forgot to bring a Kleenex. A pill that's a bomb inside the stomach of a man inside the embassy blows up. Eructations of flame, luxurious cauliflowers, giganticize into motion. The entire 29-foot screen is orange as crackling flesh and brick bursting, blackening, smithereened. I unwrap a dentine, and while jouncing my teeth in rubber tongue-smarting clove, try with the 2-inch-wide paper to blot butter off of my fingers."
This is the end of side one.
14 girls, delectable and sexless, twist-topped creamy friezes, their blonde, red, brown, pinkish, lavender, or silver wiglets all screwed that high and varnished. Scrub tickle a lone male whose chest has just the right amount and distribution of curly hair. He's nervously pretending to defend his modesty. His crotch below the waterline is also below the frame, but unsubmerged, all 28 slick, foamy boobs. Their makeup fails to let the girls look naked. Caterpillar lashes, black and thick, lush lips glossed pink like the gum I pop and chew. Contact lenses on the eyes that are mostly blue. They're nose-perfect replicas of each other. I've got most of the grease off and onto this little square of paper. I'm folding it now, making creases with my nails. In constructing my own particular paradise, I look forward to a time when, as the lamb is allowed to lie down with the lion, we can also lay to rest the notions that spirituality and sensuality are mutually exclusive, and that sex, love, and danger should be confined to separate compartments in our psyches. That is, when we are persuaded to think about them at all. Thank you.
Stephen and I have other jokes, too, about screenwriting. I tell people I'm a freelance writer, emphasizing the word free. Sometimes that comes down to the fact that I write what I want to write and nobody else wants to invest their money in that. And sometimes it's maybe because I don't write as well. I never can quite tell. But Paul's paper has raised some questions in my mind, or actually has allowed me a little format, I guess, to address some questions that I've had for some time, both in watching films and attending plays, and then writing myself and trying to decide what I would write. He touches early on kind of the essence of screenwriting and, I suppose, theater writing, which is all writing of that sort is based on conflict. You can't tell a story in a very interesting manner unless there's some kind of conflict in the story. How you choose or what you choose to have is the conflict, and how you hope to use it or exploit it determines the type of piece you're going to do. But from his paper, he says, "There is a germ of paradoxical but plausible significance that film writers like Paul Verhoeven and John Badham are, however clumsily, exploring. Love, commitment, and passion are sometimes born in the crucible of opposition. Risk can be a catharsis that opens us up to ourselves and to others. Pressured by contemporary life, we may burst the artificial barriers often imposed between spirituality and sensuality. Conflict creates a format for us to be able to do those things." He refers to Rambo, and story. If you've seen Rambo, you've seen almost every film like Rambo, I think. I haven't seen Rambo, but
I envy you.
But I. But I feel like I have. Their book, and you used the term comic book mentality, or written as comic book violence. Okay. There was an interesting interview in the newspaper this last week. I don't know if who saw it, but I jotted it down, realizing that you would be talking about Paul Verhoeven. I assume that's how you say his name. But, but he talks about RoboCop. Another film I haven't seen but feel like I have. He says, or the article, this is quoting the article, when Verhoeven directed RoboCop, he deliberately directed it as comic book, he says. The violence was meant to be so wild as to approach Monty Python routines. Good Cop Murphy's death was initially filmed with long shots of his gunshot-severed arms flying into the air. And in the scene in which corporate greed robot glitches and accidentally machine guns down an unfortunate functionary in the boardroom, Verhoeven says the early versions showed such outrageous slow motion gore that screening audiences fell apart with laughter when they saw it, because they thought it was really a comic book move, he says. And it was so much over the top that it's not cruel anymore. But much of that feeling was gutted, Verhoeven argues, when the Motion Picture Association of America insisted the violence be toned down. The peculiar effect, he says, was to work realism and more disturbing violence back in. It's curious to me. We're talking about an industry that lives to some extent on violence, and that toning down a film because it has too much violence. I remember talking with George Romero, who did the films Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead and things like that, and he couldn't, at one point he couldn't get a distributor for one of his films because it had too much violence in it. And yet it was too much blood, they told him. But it wasn't a moral decision that they had made. It was a commercial decision. They felt like they couldn't sell that to the public. Eventually, the film went off and actually did quite well, probably to the regret of the distributor who turned it down. But I feel like Verhoeven's comments here of making comic book violence is a cop-out. He was actually a fairly serious filmmaker until he made this film. My gut-level feeling is that basically he wanted a successful film. And there's a tremendous amount of pressure put on people who have that desire to do films, to basically go and do a film that they can sell to the public and sell in a big way that allows them to make more films. When he says it's a comic book piece, he says it in a way that what he's excusing himself for having promoted this violence on the screen. He's doing that, he doesn't want to own up to the fact that perhaps he's becoming a part of the violence that exists in the world today, by saying that it's a comic book violence. But I object to that personally, and I know this doesn't address directly what you were talking about, but I disagree with that, because I think there's a lot of people in our culture who see life in comic book images, who divide things into easy categories of good and bad. And this goes all across the political spectrum and across non-political spectrums. We heard in the preceding session here a political speech that somehow didn't address any of the problems of homelessness that I saw. That was the session we were in. But it was a comic book approach to try and understand what problems persist in the world, and in dividing things easily into good and bad. I feel like people making these films are copping out by doing that. They're helping these things to persist in the world. And then they tell us that because it's a comic book violence, that it's not meaningful violence. There are things about this. There are people in our country who are searching for identities and who actually, I think, grab a hold of the Rambo mentality. We'll probably see people going around dressed up like RoboCop in the future. One thing about those films is that they emphasize the external things. They almost invariably never get inside a character or inside anybody. It's all action seen from the surface, all life seen from the surface, without any kind of analysis. Paul, I think, would agree with me on that, and his paper doesn't disagree with it. But as we move into some of the other areas, I think it's important, I guess, to have that in perspective, those comments. On the two films that he addresses primarily in his paper, Room with a View and Blue Velvet, they're two completely different films. I don't know how many people saw those films. A Room with a View, I thought, was a wonderful picture. It reminded me of the old British comedies, character comedies. And I disagree to some extent with its use in this paper. And that's primarily because I don't think the film really challenged us to cross any barriers. I felt this type of film, in fact, I feel is almost, it's mildly challenging, but it's almost there as an excuse to introduce to us a whole bevy of fun characters and to kind of romp with them through life for a few minutes. As I thought back on it and tried to understand anything I might have learned, I think there was some challenge in Lucy's challenge. Is she going to accept the more secure life? And it's hard with Cecil to understand how that might have been seen as a more secure life. But we might see it in that sense, as George as being the more adventurous person, the more adventurous outlet in life. Cecil is perhaps, you know, the intellectual giant, quote-unquote. Perhaps on that level we can see that, but I think primarily as I think about that film, I see that one crazy novelist leading Charlotte, cousin Charlotte, through the streets of Italy, talking about the simple souls. And I just enjoying those moments. I seem to, those characters at that moment caught a little bit of myself, the pretentiousness that I have at times, and maybe in that sense it is challenging. But the film as a whole I didn't find particularly challenging in that sense. It was just enjoyable, a lot of fun. There was one moment for myself, and I think my wife said she thought about Lucy's predicament, thinking back to the time of who would she marry, that type of thing, and tossed it about. Myself, I was a little bit moved by the father-son relationship, George and his father. There was a moment in the picture when George kissed his father on the head, forehead, and the concern that the father had for the son, it seemed to be his overriding concern in life. It made me reflect back a little bit on my own relationship with my father, you know, what it lacked and what it had. And there was a nice moment in the piece. But I can't say that I was dragged through anything to really analyze what was in it. And largely because, and this is a little similar actually to the other films that I talked about, all the action in Room with a View is on the surface, basically. We really never are invited inside the characters because it is a character piece. It's meant as a character piece. In a sense, it's not meant to be taken realistically as such. It's just meant to be enjoyed. We recognize a little bit of ourselves probably in every character there. It's a reason to bring that wide range of characters together. When I think about Blue Velvet, which I never would have seen had it not been mentioned in this paper, because I've seen too many films that are full of sex and violence, and I find that I can't go to sleep afterwards. And I've been backpacking in the Canyonlands after seeing some of these films and wondered if some sniper had his sights on me. They fill my life with a certain amount of paranoia. And I felt that after going to bed that night, after seeing Blue Velvet. I couldn't sleep for at least 2 hours. I was keyed up because of the character of Frank Booth, who is probably, he's more despicable than Adolf Hitler. There was no charm even. I mean, there's nothing to justify this man's existence. And I have to admit, I question whether there was anything to justify the film's existence. It's an incredibly well-crafted film. It's certainly on that level, it's probably one of the best pieces to be made that year. And I was mesmerized by it. When it was over, I didn't want it to be over. I wanted it to go on because he had got me into his grip. He had worked it so well. And yet when the spell was gone and I had to deal with the 2 hours of sleeplessness and began to resent what he had done to me, and then began to ponder, what have I learned? I mean, I've paid a price for this film. What have I learned from the film? I kept coming up with goose eggs. I cannot think of what the film had to offer me, and I've asked myself why.
Should have been goosebumps.
I had a lot of those. But this film, this conjures up for me one of the primary things that I think that is going on today among people who are intellectual filmmakers and theater writers, and writers in general, is that probably the most articulate people in our society have lost a real moral perspective. They have a tremendous ability to perceive what is going on around them in people's lives, but they have no perspective from which to look at those things. I'm a great fan of Sam Shepard. I think the guy writes incredibly well. I envy him. And there was another play I went to see up at Salt Lake Acting Company. It was also so well written. But their pieces lack any sense of where to come from or where to go to. And so basically they end up analyzing the hell we live in. That's the way they see it. They see the arguments and the conflicts between people, and that's all. They don't see the potential. They don't see what might come out of that or how people grow, because they have no idea where we might be headed to, and yet they can articulate these things so well that they overwhelm us while we're watching them. In Blue Velvet, my feeling was, you know, we talk about a quiet life of domestic desperation. I feel like at times people want to escape that. They feel insulated from a life they may see on the streets, and they wonder what's going on in that life, and they want to see it, but they don't want to be touched by it, so they go to the movies to see it. And that's a little bit of what happened with Blue Velvet. It was our chance, you know, in our insulated lives, to get into a world that we really don't want to be in, but we'd like to see. And so I kind of agree with the voyeuristic criticisms of that film. I feel like they were more interested in portraying the decadence. And you see it when you try to weigh what is going on in there. There is redemption in the film, in a sense, but the redemption is without conviction. It's lip service redemption. And yet there is total conviction in the depravity, absolute conviction. So the depravity comes off as the most real thing, and the sides of redeeming love and whatnot come off as completely unreal and impossible. So basically, when I leave a film like that, I feel hopeless. I feel as though there's no real resources to call upon, because these people who are terribly articulate don't really believe in redemption. There's no fundamental conviction on their part. They'll give it lip service to justify the depravity that they're going to show us and the hell they're going to take us through. But it's only a justification for themselves. I felt in Blue Velvet that was basically the case. There was no redemption in it, and there was no ascent from hell. In fact, ironically, the scene he's talking to, which is a lovely scene in which Laura Dern describes this dream of no love in the world in a dark place, and because I think the robins have escaped and have left the planet, and then at the end of her dream they come down and the world is filled with brightness and the music of birds and that type of thing. At the end of the film, we're given these robins. And ironically, the robin that they give us as the symbol of love is a mechanical robin. It's not a real bird. And it looks like a fake bird. And the love they're portraying is as phony as the bird that's sitting there singing. I guess my assessment of films like that is that they're kind of an intellectual's Rambo. They, in the same way that other people want to put machine guns on their backs and tromp through the woods, you know, they were given those films on such a mediocre level in which the mind isn't taxed one bit. Other more articulate filmmakers are addressing films to people who want to think, and yet really want basically the same type of thrill, but intellectually, that those other people want in the jungle somewhere. These are simply my opinions about this. My feeling is that there needs to be some filmmaking that addresses the true morality that needs to be felt. For these films to work, you have to start from some point of conviction and then take people through hell and then come back. They have to feel like once they've been there that they've learned something when they come back. And I guess I don't believe that. I'll read one last thing that from that interview with Paul Verhoeven. And it applies to a lot of these things, a lot of these films. I think, and this is quoting him directly, I think in a lot of people, this enjoyment of destruction is a basic element of the human soul. And that's the stuff that drama is made of. You can't make drama with beauty and happiness. You can make, perhaps, music with that to a certain degree, but even with music, you need opposition and counterpoint. I think there is that great fascination with destruction, but I don't think a good many of these people really quite grasp the beauty that is there, and they don't present it to us. Anyway, those are my comments.
We have a question in the back, and then we'll pick some more up here.
Did you hear the question? From what I heard, I think the question is, she wasn't sure after listening to my presentation what the positive value is of love, sex, and danger in the movies. Well, I addressed that in one direct way, and I can maybe address it in some indirect ways. I said the positive value of love, sex, and danger in the movies is that we may be forced to confront stereotypical notions of what may constitute trouble in our own particular paradise. If love, sex, and danger are portrayed not only skillfully but with heart, with understanding, with with an attempt to deepen life experience, with an attempt to engage us in having a dialogue with the film we are seeing, as well as with others who we may talk about it with afterwards, in a way that opens up our own consciousness of what we believe about paradise, either in this life or otherwise, then perhaps a film has done something for us. I think that in responding both to you and to Paul to some degree, Blue Velvet, I don't deal with what goes on in the last part of the film in my paper. I end it at the point where Jeffrey is confronted with these terrible dichotomies in his life and what he is to do about it. Dorothy is taken to the hospital at that point, and later that evening he receives a call from Sandy. Sandy, of course, totally obliterated by what she saw between he and Dorothy in her mother's living room earlier that evening, knowing that there is feeling there, knowing that it is probably sexual feeling there, knowing that in some part of her, knowing that he loves her, loves Sandy, wondering how to deal with these kinds of dissonances. Sandy, in a terribly convincing scene as far as I'm concerned, without saying it explicitly, forgives Jeffrey and tells him that she loves him. Jeffrey, being forgiven, is empowered to help with the saving of Dorothy, and ultimately in a final scene in which there are symbols of the forgotten the word I need of the there are symbols of the power of the what's the key word I'm looking for?
I'm not sure.
the thank you. Redemption's never there when you need it. The power of the redemption is symbolized both in Sandy's forgiveness of Jeffrey and Jeffrey's ability to bring Dorothy out of the hell she is trapped in. And there is a final scene in which all of the characters we identify with, the characters we care about, are reunited, including Dorothy's son. Then there is the Robin Paul speaks of. I'm going to go back and look at it again. He tells me it's a mechanical Robin. He noticed something I didn't notice, if that's the case. There is a worm in the beak of that Robin.
A mechanical worm.
Paul feels it's mechanical. Feels the ending is mechanical. I don't. I feel there's a great deal of feeling there. I feel there is redemptive power. And it causes us to look at all of our conceptions about love, about sex, about violence even, and about risk and danger. Therefore, it is... I feel it is, yes. redemptive power may be one aspect. In this kind of a film that deals explicitly with it, it certainly needs to be there. I think in a film like Room with a View, which Paul takes on a lighter level, and that light level is a beautiful level, and it's there. There, as far as I'm concerned, there's a lot more underneath that is also redemptive in its way.
Paul? Yeah, okay.
Blue Velvet left me cold, but it was incredibly crafted, and I agree with most of what Paul said about the movie. However, in that movie and in RoboCop, which unfortunately isn't like movies that you may think it is, it's very different. It does raise violence to a new level of tolerance for the moviegoer, which really made objective to that, because it had the potential for developing the character RoboCop. There was some attempt at getting into this computer half-man, trying to identify with his past life and remembering his past.
Yeah, ironically, it deals rather directly with what's inside, although it doesn't completely bring that off. It attempts to. I'm very mixed about that film, and I agree with a lot of what Paul said. But I think he hasn't really figured out what he's doing with the film.
Well, is there another? Okay, well, if anybody wants to come and talk a little bit more about favorite films, we can.
This is the end of this cassette.